Welcome back to Crow and Fern's Guide to Weird Fiction, Folklore, Mythology, and Everything in Between, where I, Fern, talk about folklore and mythology, and Crow talks about weird fiction. Say hi, Crow.
Hi, I'm the one who talks about weird fiction. My cat's screaming in the background, I'm sorry.
Unforgivable. Anyway, so I know this is my first episode for a little while, and I wanted to kind of talk about why, because this is actually why what the episode is about as well. So about a month ago, my brother passed away, and it was by his hand, so to speak. So we've been dealing a lot with that, plus me managing to injure myself, which was just dumb. It's led to me thinking a lot about, you know, death and the things that kind of follow and all of that. And so I wanted to make an episode that was dedicated to him. Maybe it's silly, but I just wanted to memorialize him in some way. You know I have a tiny platform, but I wanted to use it to talk about that and how the folklore and the mythology tie into death and how they can help us cope with that and some of the heavier things. So big trigger warning here. This is going to be a heavier episode, and it is going to deal with difficult topics like suicide and death. And if that is too much for anyone, I understand. That's fine. You know, I was also thinking while my mind was heavy on this and while I was really thinking a lot about it, perhaps there were other people out there as well that could use a little comfort. And I don't know, I think we try and avoid talking about these things a lot, but
yeah,
that sometimes we need to, you know, sometimes there are people that need to hear it. Anyway, so we're going to jump right in. Anyway, so you ready, Crow?
Yes.
For a heavy episode?
For what it's worth, I don't think it's silly. I think that as small as you think the platform is, I'm pretty sure this will reach people who will need it. So,
yeah,
I respect you doing the episode is what I'm trying to say.
I appreciate that. People who have listened to us for a while have probably heard me talk about being autistic. My brother was also autistic, and he faced some struggles related to that. He had a sense of isolation, I think, and feeling constantly misunderstood and stuff like that. And I think that ultimately contributed to what happened. Because we were both autistics, we saw the world in a similar way, and we were able to connect with the world in a similar way. And we always shared a really close bond. And so when this happened, it kind of hit me hard. For so long, he struggled to find his place in the world and to find a sense of acceptance. And when you're autistic, you get called quirky and weird and, you know, things like that. And I wanted to do something to say, like, he mattered, that he meant something, you know, that he was loved.
Yeah. And he still does.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't end there.
Yeah. And so I wanted to talk about like processing grief. And I've talked before about how we use stories to process difficult emotions. And so I have been thinking about what stories I know that can help with processing some of the things that I've been feeling and some of the things that other people might feel. And went on a journey, so to speak, to see what folklore could teach us about this. And even though this is a heavy episode, I do want to reassure the listeners that this will not be overwhelmingly heavy or dark, because even though this is a dark topic, we're still looking for the hope that exists. And basically, how you come through something this heavy, how you come out on the other end and be okay. And so it's not just going to be a focus on the pain and the suffering or anything like that.
Yeah.
What I want to share is also the search for hope that I went through and that I think we all kind of go through when we hit something difficult.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of people struggle with suicidal thoughts and are in some way affected by things like that. And yet we're taught never to talk about it, like it's some sort of taboo. So how are we supposed to help those who struggle either with ideations or are struggling with the loss of a loved one if we don't talk about it? I think that's true. If we can't discuss this difficult topic, we risk leaving people who are having a hard time feeling isolated and alone, like there's something wrong with them, when the truth is that their struggles are valid and that there are people who understand what they're going through because they've been through it too. I think if we can learn to talk about it more, whether that's through stories or just opening up more, then we can find healthy ways to help people to fight suicidal ideations or to help people who have suffered the loss of a loved one and better support people.
Yeah. And like there is a very common myth, even amongst psychologists and people in the medical field, that talking about suicide can increase the risk of suicidal ideation and self-harming behavior. But there have been a lot of recent studies nowadays that show that that's not really the case. It's because, like, one theory is that fears that are shared, that are put out there, are at least less likely to build up into action. So if someone trusts you with that kind of information or, like, puts it out there, then, you know, like Fern said, at least there will be a chance for them to get help instead of, like...
Yeah.
Yeah, because oftentimes... when your brain is dealing with things like depression, anxiety, or other mental illnesses, you create your own echo chamber where things start to seem hopeless and there's only one way out. Whereas when you share it with other people, they might be able to give you another perspective. So I do think it's something that we should encourage people to talk about. It's like not everyone who talks about suicide is going to talk to you about how to do it. It's more about providing other solutions, but validating the person's feelings.
Yeah, yeah. I think it is one of those things where, you know, if you bottle things up for a long time, they start to get out of control. If you talk about them and you get help and you work through them, then they become manageable. You know, you find ways to get through. And I do want to say, like, as far as folklore is concerned, not everything is got a healthy message. When I was reading through some of these stories about death and all of that, there's a lot of very unhealthy messaging about death, suicide, and grieving in stories. And I think this is why you have to kind of search a bit to find ones where wisdom is stored. Before we get into like some of my favorite stories, I do want to talk a little bit about some of the messaging that we need to get past, because there is some really negative messages out there. And I apologize, this episode is going to be structured in a very different way. It's going to be a little bit all over the place. I do have a few stories to share with you. Just recognize that this is an atypical episode, and that's, I think, just the way it needs to be in this case. But like I said, I want to get over some of the negative messages that we've been heard, that we've been told. Mm-hmm. People who have listened to some of our earlier episodes probably remember hearing the episode when I did Romanian vampires. It seemed like one of the biggest risk factors for becoming pretty much any type of vampire was suicide. And that's not unique to Romanian folklore. When you look at stories of vampires, zombies, all sorts of evil undead monsters around the world, a lot of times the message is that they are spawned by the act of suicide. The living person gives up their humanity and goodness and returns to something, some sort of hideous monster of death and evil, now intent on making other people suffer. And this philosophy is shown in the 13th canto of Dante's Inferno, which I think should definitely be taken as folklore and not scripture, even though I've seen some people try and take it as scripture. It is not. In which those who take their lives are turned into trees. Their humanity is lost. Their voices are taken from them as they become little more than plants. Mm-hmm. Trees of poisonous thorns forever tormented by harpies that enjoy causing them pain. And we're pushed to believe that this punishment is fitting, that this is the only fate they could ever deserve for the crime they committed against themselves. There was a time in my life when I was small and impressionable, when there was something of an outbreak of suicides in my area. Times were difficult, and a lot of people took their lives, one after another. It was like a disease that spread, a contagion of thought. And for whatever reason, people have a tendency to just tell me things. And I think like part of it is when I was young, I was one of those autistic kids that almost never spoke. And when I did, it was just like very well thought through. And mm-hmm. so, you know, the combination of the big wide-eyed expression and the quiet, like me just listening, people would open up to me and tell me things. And that included adults telling me things you probably shouldn't tell a child. And so that would happen. There were people who would just open up and talk to me about things like that. And one of them was this neighbor woman that we had. She had lost her daughter mm-hmm. to suicide. And she seemed constantly distressed. She believed that her daughter had been so mad at her that that was why she had taken her life. And she said, she told me that her daughter would visit her in her dreams. And she was a distorted and angry version of herself, like a fractured version of what she had been, shouting unintelligible words at her. And she appeared stuck in that same rage that she had when she took her life. And this was the image of suicide that I had for many years. It was an idea that was reinforced by religious leaders who tried to drive home to us with extra fervence in light of the fact that so many people were taking their lives, that suicide would not free you from the pain that you were suffering, but rather the torment that you felt when you took your life would accompany you for eternity and would become inescapable forever because you had cemented yourself within it by taking your life. Whereas if you managed to endure it in life, you would have the ability to earn peace and happiness in the afterlife. And I know, like, Crow, you and I come from different religious backgrounds. There's a lot of similarities. And I know you were saying that you'd been taught similar things.
Yeah, I've never agreed with it growing up. Like, it's the same thing. It's basically the thought is that because we don't just believe that life ends at death until judgment day. What's actually believed is that when you pass away, you kind of go into another life, which is like limbo until judgment day comes. So it's like people who take their own lives in limbo, they would keep taking their lives every day until the day of judgment, and then they would be punished or whatever. But I've never believed that because medically speaking, I don't believe that anyone takes their own life without being sick, like actually being mm-hmm. sick, any type of mental illness, you know? And for example, in Islam, at least as far as I know, if you're sick, then God doesn't punish you for being sick, you know? So, mm-hmm. because I don't know, I've read a lot of stories of people who survived attempts and they always say they ended up regretting it in the act. So mm-hmm. it's not something that someone who is conscious does. So I genuinely don't think that God would punish anyone who was going through something like that. I just don't believe it. I refuse to believe it.
Yeah.
I feel like he's a lot more merciful than that. He understands the struggle that these people must have been going through. And God cares for his own. I feel like people sometimes treat God the way that they treat other human beings, like they view God the way that they view human beings. So they're like, yeah, he would get angry or something, but I don't know. It's just not something mm-hmm. I believe. But yeah, I understand where you're coming from, where it's like most Abrahamic yeah. religions hold that thought.
I know you and I have had plenty of conversations about this over the course of the last month.
Yeah, sorry, I went over.
And I agree. I agree. I think there's more mercy there, but we'll get further into mm-hmm. that. The vilification of suicide in people who die that way is a preventative measure. If a population or a person is at risk, then the age-old answer has been to make suicide as terrifying and awful-seeming as possible. Fear and horror are placed around it as a deterrent for the act, and while we might applaud the effort when it saves someone's life, this method of making it seem as horrible as possible has some very serious issues and can cause some problems. First, it can make it harder for someone who's struggling by making them feel like the mere fact that they're having a hard time means that they're doing something wrong, when in fact, it's pretty normal to struggle. I would say that most people have had times where they've struggled with suicidal ideations. I know I have, and I know a lot of people have opened up to me about having those struggles as well. And the fact that you feel that way doesn't make you a failure. It doesn't mean mm-hmm. that you've done something wrong. In fact, that struggle is actually pretty normal.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a sin, and it's not a sign that something is wrong with you.
Exactly.
Life is difficult. Life can be very hard. And to struggle sometimes, or even a lot, is okay. It's okay to have a hard time sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I promise you're doing better than you think you are.
Yeah.
Second, when we try to make suicide as terrible as possible in the stories we tell and the beliefs that we pass on, we compound the grieving process for those who are left behind.
Yes.
Significantly. If I hold to the belief that anyone who takes their life goes straight to hell,
mm-hmm.
then not only do I have to mourn the loss of my brother, but I have to cope with the grief that the soul of my gentle, compassionate, thoughtful brother is suffering and cannot be redeemed.
Yeah.
And the thought of someone you love dearly becoming a distorted, eternally tortured version of themselves with no chance of peace is impossibly difficult.
Yeah.
And makes it considerably harder to go through the process of mourning the loss of a loved one. And that's on top of the additional complexity of this type of loss.
Yeah.
All of the questions and complicated emotions that hit you when a loved one takes their life.
Yeah.
So what do you do then? How do we talk about something like suicide in a way that will help prevent it in those with ideations, without causing unnecessary distress to those who have lost a loved one to it? How can we start telling better stories to process this type of death?
Yeah.
You know, as I was thinking about this, there's one story that always comes to mind when I think about this subject matter, and it's actually a recent one. It's not even folklore. I'm just going to mention it because I think it's a good book for anyone who's struggling. It's called What Dreams May Come. It was made into a movie, but it was a book by Richard Matheson in 1978. And just to sum it up really quickly, this man and his children all pass away. They're in heaven, and his wife is left behind, and she is alone and struggling. And you feel really awful for her because it's terrible to lose your entire family. And she ends up taking her life. And she goes to hell, but they do clarify, and I think this is a good clarification, that it's not because she's being punished. It's because she is in such a terrible mental state that she is in a prison of her own making. And when he learns that she's gone to hell because of that, he decides to descend into hell to try and save her and bring her back. Mm-hmm. And this is what always comes to mind, and this is what came to my mind. Because, you know, I was concerned about my brother. I have to admit, like, the thought of what is happening to him in the afterlife was bothering me. And so I was like, is that something that we can do? Is that something I could do for him?
It's okay, man.
Because I know. Because I would rather go through hell to get him than lose him forever.
It's okay.
I know. And that is one of those things, you know, like, because someone needs to be in such a bad mental state to take their life, I think we often imagine them being in a terrible state in the afterlife. And so I thought, like, how would I approach him? What would I say to kind of bring him back to a state of peace? And this is where our first folklore story comes in. It's from Japan. It's called The Crescent Moon Bear, and it deals with how we help people who don't necessarily want to be helped. This is the story. There was a woman who lived in a pine forest, and her husband went off to war to fight for many years. And when he was released from duty, he came home in a terrible state. He didn't even want to enter the house. He was so used to sleeping on stones outside. He kept to himself, and he went into the forest, and he refused to talk to anyone. His young wife was really excited when she'd learned that he was coming home. And she went and she began making preparations. She'd cleaned the house. She went to the market and she got all of these beautiful ingredients to make him special meals. You know, everything that he liked to make, his favorite types of fish, all sorts of beautiful prawns. And she cooked for ages. And she went outside to where he was in the forest because he was doing that. And she laid out all of these beautiful dishes she had spent hours and hours preparing and invited him to eat. And he just knocked everything over and he says, "Leave me alone." And he turned his back on her. He became so angry that she was frightened. And she tried a couple of times. She tried bringing him food, tried talking to him. Every time he lost his temper, he yelled at her. He refused to accept anything she brought. And she wasn't quite sure what to do. And so she went to the cave of a healer who lived outside the village. She says, "My husband has been badly injured in the war, and he is angry all the time. He stays outside like an animal, and he will not live with me as he used to. Can you give me a potion that will fix this, that will make him love me again?" The healer said, "I can do that for you, but I need a special ingredient. What I need is a hair from the crescent moon bear. So you have to climb the mountain, find the bear, and bring me back a single hair from the crescent moon at its throat." And this is a real bear. Like, if you haven't seen him, you can Google, like, the moon bear. It's a black bear with, like, a lighter crescent shape on its chest.
I think I've seen them.
They're more common in Asia, which, I mean, this story's in Japan, so that makes sense. But she says, "So bring me back a hair from the crescent moon on its throat, and then I can give you what you need. I'll make you the potion." So it seemed like a daunting task, but this young woman was very determined, and she wanted to give it a go. So she's like, "Okay, I'll do it. I'm going to go. It's enough for me to know that we can do this." So she gets ready for her journey, and the next morning she heads out, and she's going along, and she sings out "Arigato Zaisho," which I probably butchered, but I tried. You know, she's greeting the mountain and saying, "Thank you for letting me climb on your body." And she climbed up the foothills and saw the boulders, and she climbed past this plateau covered with forest. She just kept on saying, like, "Arigato Zaisho," thanking the trees for lifting their branches so she could pass underneath. And she found her way through the forest, and she kept climbing. And it got harder. The mountain had thorny flowers that grabbed at her clothes. The rocks scraped her hands. She saw strange birds flying above and the shadows of animals moving in the forest. And she knew that those were spirits of the dead who had no relatives. And she sang out prayers for them, saying, "I will be your relative. I will lay you to rest," which is, you know,
yeah,
kind of a traditional thing to do. She climbed on. And she climbed until she saw snow on the mountain peak. Her feet were wet and cold, and she just kept on going. And she was determined to save the man she loved. Mm-hmm. And a storm began, and the snow blew, and snowflakes blew into her eyes and into her ears, and she couldn't see, she couldn't hear, but she kept climbing. And when the snow stopped, the woman sang out "Arigato" to thank the wind for ceasing to blind her. And she took shelter in a little cave that was barely big enough for her to fit herself into. And she had a full pack of food, but she did not eat. She covered herself in leaves and slept. And in the morning, when things were calm and everything was brightly lit again, she went out to look for the bear. Now she thought she could find it. She searched all day, and it was nearly night before she saw signs that a bear had been there. Before long, she was able to see the giant shape of a black bear lumbering across the snow, leaving deep footprints in its wake. The crescent moon bear roared fiercely and entered its den. And she reached into her bundle where she had her food and placed the food that she had brought in a bowl. And she set the bowl outside the den, and then she ran back to her shelter to hide. The bear smelled the food, and then it slowly peeked out, saw the food that she had left. It roared loudly, so loudly that it shook the stones, and it circled around the food from a distance, sniffing the air. And then finally, when it was satisfied, it ate the food in one single gulp. And then it reared up, sniffed the air again, and disappeared into its den. The next evening, she did the same. She set out the food, but this time, instead of returning to hide in the shelter, she retreated only halfway. The bear smelled the food, peeked out of its den, roared again, and then circled around the food again. Loved the little details, because this is a very animal thing to do. When it was finally satisfied that, you know, it was safe, it gobbled up the food and crawled back into its den. And this continued for several nights until finally the woman felt brave enough to wait even closer to the bear's den. She put the food in the bowl outside the den and stood right by the opening. When the bear smelled the food and came out, it saw not only the usual food, but also a pair of tiny human feet as well. Okay. The bear turned its head sideways and roared so loudly that made her bones shake within her. She trembled, but she stood her ground. The bear hauled itself back on its legs, smacked its jaw, and roared so loudly that the woman could see right up into the red and brown roof of its mouth. But she did not run. The bear roared even more, and it reached out its arms as if it was going to grab her, its claws hanging like knives over her. The woman shook, but she stayed where she was. "Oh, please, dear bear," she pleaded. "Please, dear bear, I've come all this way because I need a cure for my husband." And the bear seemed to pause. It put its paws back on the earth, and it looked at the woman, looking into her frightened eyes. "Please, bear, I've been feeding you all these past nights. Can I please just have a single hair from the crescent moon on your throat?" The bear hesitated. This woman would surely be easy prey. But suddenly he seemed to be filled with pity. "It is true," said the bear. "You've been good to me. I will give you one of my hairs. But take it and then leave and go back home and never return."
Okay.
The bear raised its snout so that the crescent moon on its throat was visible, and the woman very carefully reached out and plucked a single hair from the bear's throat. And the bear reared back, and she thought for a moment it would strike, but then it settled into annoyed huffs. "Thank you, Crescent Moon Bear. Thank you so much," the woman bowed and bowed. But the bear growled and took a step forward. It roared at the woman in words that she could not understand, and she turned and she fled down the mountain as fast as she could. She ran all the way through the forest, down the rocks, all the way calling out "Arigato" to thank the bear, the trees, the very stars, everything around her, that she had succeeded. And when she reached the bottom of the mountain, her clothes were ragged, her hair askew, but she wasted no time running straight to the healer's hut, holding out the hair, saying, "I have it, I have it, I have a hair from the Crescent Moon Bear." "Good," said the healer with a smile. She looked closely at the woman and took the little hair from her hands, and she held it out to look at it in the light. And she said, "Yes, this is a real authentic hair from the Crescent Moon Bear." Then she took that hair and she tossed it into the fire, where it burned up immediately in a little orange flame. "No," cried the young woman. "What have you done?" "Be calm. It will be okay," said the healer. "Remember every step you took to climb the mountain. Remember every step you took to capture the trust of the Crescent Moon Bear. Remember what you saw, what you heard, what you felt." "Yes," said the woman, "I remember very well." The old healer smiled at her gently and said, "Now, go home with this new understanding that you have and proceed in the same way with your husband." So it wasn't about the potion, it was about the lesson. And it was about the patience and the careful approach of love that the woman had to have to reach the Crescent Moon Bear the same way that she had to do to reach her husband. Because it's not easy when someone is in that state of mind to get through to them. It isn't going to be easy. It's going to be a long process, and it's going to be difficult, and it's going to require a lot of patience and sometimes even fear.
Yeah. I think it's really difficult because, well, I feel like when someone is in that state of mind, like, it hurts to see them going through it because we don't always have the tools to reach them. I feel like sometimes no matter how patient you are, they need more than that, you know? They need patience, but they need more to get them out of the state that they're in. And it's not the wife's fault, and it's not the husband's fault. It's just a really shitty situation for everyone to be caught in.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I get what the story is trying to say, but at the same time, it's also just a really, I don't know how to put it into words. It's because I've seen people go through that. Like, I've seen people get stuck in depression, and it's really painful because I feel like when people think of mental illnesses, they just think of, you know, mental, you can get over it with enough love, you can be brought out of it. But sometimes I think of them in the context of like things like cancer, where no matter how much you love the person, there's just something wrong, you know?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful story. Like, I do think it's a beautiful story. And I think part of it is pointing that out, mm-hmm. which is that You know, she started out trying to love her husband back to health, didn't she? When she was just trying to cook his favorite meals and just trying to be there for him. And she wasn't realizing that there was more that needed to be done. Like the kindness that she offered, I don't know, the environment around her as she was climbing up to the bear. And like you said, the patience that she offered. And again, part of it being the fear.
Right. And I think like when you love someone who is lost into a state of like anger and pain, really, you can't force them to go at a rate that's faster than what they want to go.
Yes.
You can't force them to heal.
Exactly.
And so all you really can do is show patience and support and love mm-hmm. and compassion. And that's not a guarantee that things will get better. But I think if anything's going to work, that's going to be it. You know, like
that's true.
For them to come from a state where they're hurt and maybe their trust is gone, because sometimes that's a problem too, is, you know, people have lost the ability to trust other people. And it takes time. Mm-hmm. It takes time for them to see that they can rely on you and that you are going to be there for them and to open up. And you can't rush it. You can't rush it, and you can't force it to happen. And you can't guarantee that it will happen, but I think that that patient sort of love is the sort of thing that can reach people even in that dark state.
I agree. I think you're right.
I think a lot of people, there's a lot of judgment in society and in stories and even now against people who have taken their own lives. And sometimes I think that we judge them harshly. Our society is not kind to people who commit suicide. And while I definitely would say, like, you know, like, seek help, please don't take your life, I would also encourage people to show understanding to those people who have taken their lives and to try and understand what they were going through and the pain that they felt and to show sympathy for them.
See, that's the thing that I keep thinking, is that the reason I compare it to other kinds of diseases is because you wouldn't hate someone for dying of cancer. You wouldn't hate someone for dying of degenerative neurological disease. You wouldn't hate them for dying of pneumonia. Mm-hmm. So why would you hate them and look down on them for dying of a mental illness? And I think it's really messed up, because I don't blame individuals for people taking their lives, you know, because it's not an individual problem. But we have to admit that a huge part of it is society as a whole. People who feel like they don't belong or that there's no place for them in the world. So you can't be shitty to them as a society while they were alive, and then when they pass away, you're shitty to them for them passing away. Like, that is just so messed up to me.
Yeah. When my brother passed, and then I know I talked to you about a lot of this as it was happening, but there were people in my family who were angry at him for taking his life. And I think that made grieving very difficult. For me, though, I know he and I had had a lot of talks about his struggles, and I know that he was in pain and he was suffering and he was in a terrible state. And for me, the comforting thing and the thing that kind of helped me move forward was to realize that he isn't suffering anymore. There's a story about this that I want to share, and I have been thinking about this one a lot. This one's called La Huesera. I'm sorry if I mispronounced that. It's the Bone Lady. And it tells a story that really, really reminded me of my brother. So there was a young girl who married an old man. And he was awful and abusive. He worked her hard. He would starve her. He would beat her. And when she wasn't able to give him any children, he cast her off. She was left alone in the desert with no food or water or shelter. She hid in the shade of rocks by day when the sun was strong. And by night she walked crying because she couldn't find her way home. Nights were cold. Wolves prowled. Vultures flew overhead. She was hungry, thirsty, tired, and walked till she could go no further. When her strength was gone, she lay down. She wrapped herself in a long white skin and said, Let the bone woman take me, for I am done. And she died.
Yeah.
Wild animals ate her flesh. Her spirit watched over her white bones and felt neither sorrow nor fear. The bones lay there until the moon was full once more, and the bone woman came and put them in her sack. The old woman took the bones to her cave, high in the mountaintop, and she laid them out beside the fire. And she sat, and she looked at them, and smoked, and she thought, and smoked, and thought. And then she began to sing, flesh to bone, flesh to bone, flesh to bone. And as she sang, the bones began to come together to form the skeleton. And then that skeleton began to be covered in flesh. And the form of the girl came back. Where she'd been scarred and beaten, her skin was unbroken and new. Where she had been cut and hurt and starved, she was made whole. Her skin was as gold as daylight, and her hair as black as night. The bone woman sang and sang, and the young woman opened her eyes. She sat up, and she looked around her. The cave was empty, the ashes gone. The bone woman had disappeared. All that was left were tobacco seeds. And she put them in her pocket, and she left the cave, and she started for home, this time following the rising sun. She found her village with no problem walking this way, and she came upon her dwelling at last. It was dark and deserted now. The old man had died, the people told her. His poor wife died, come away from that place, because they didn't recognize this beautiful young woman who had come to them out of the West. They gave her a name and a fine set of clothes and a place to live. They taught her human speech because she had forgotten everything that she knew. She planted the bone woman's seeds and tended to the new plants, and in time she married and gave her young husband many beautiful daughters and strong sons. And the children's children's children still grow tobacco in that village today. The thing that I keep coming back to on this story is she had a difficult life, and there is sympathy for that. There's not just this blind judgment that because, you know, terrible things happened to her and she died, that means she's bad. No, there was sympathy, and the bone woman healed her after she had died. And that is what I was trying to get at, is there can be healing in death for someone who is in a lot of pain and for someone who has suffered a lot and who finds the path difficult to go.
Yeah.
That at the end there is peace. And I think that is true of all of us. And I think, like, how we're talking about how, you know, you said you don't believe that God would punish someone who was suffering that badly. And I think, you know, my brother was a kind and good and thoughtful person. And I can't see God continuing his pain. And so stories like that, where death is healing, death is not the end, death is a continuation of something, but a better version of it.
Yeah.
Is healing to me. And I think, I was going to say, the key to all of this, the key to coming to terms with death, or, you know, for all of these situations, is compassion. We need to have compassion for the person who is struggling as we reach out to them with love, and compassion for the person who has passed as we try to understand and sympathize with the pain that they were feeling that led to that decision, and compassion for ourselves, giving ourselves room to grieve and struggle and have moments where we're not okay.
Yeah. Like I said, I feel like people treat God the way that they treat each other. And the thing is, the easiest thing in the world is to say, oh, when God's testing you, you just need to buckle down and just, like, accept it. And, you know, you just need to get through it. Where they don't understand that that is the least empathetic thing I have ever heard in my entire life. And I've heard so many people say it. And I'm like, you don't know whether if you were in that situation, you would be able to bear it. And also another thing is that what you are able to bear, other people are not able to. So we were all created differently, you know? And God knows this. He knows that different people can bear different things. And we can't, I mean, I know I feel like you and I keep talking from the point of view of people who are spiritual, and I understand that not everyone is like this, and I completely respect that, but just from the point of view of someone who's spiritual, I don't think God would like see society fail a human being and then he would fail them too, because he knows. He knows that, I mean, he created this world for all of us, in my opinion. And I just feel like humans were the ones who kind of started excluding each other. And I'm not talking about like everyone, absolutely not. But I'm just saying that in some cases when this happens, you can't then go ahead and pile up and be like, oh, well, they couldn't stand the suffering of this world, so God's going to make them suffer more in the afterlife. I feel like you're right that part of it is that we're trying to deter people, or like some religions try to deter people from taking their own lives by scaring them. But psychological research has shown us time and time again that that doesn't work. It doesn't. It creates an absolute opposite situation where the person is like, okay, so there is no escape either way. You know, I'm just going to suffer here and I'm going to suffer there and nothing makes sense anymore. That's not how you're supposed to deal with it. You're supposed to offer these kinds of people healing when they need to talk about it. And if unfortunately, sometimes they don't get to a point where they can talk about it, don't hurt the people who are still alive, who are like grieving those people. Mm-hmm. Because what are you doing when you keep reiterating those stories? You're hurting the people who've lost them. They don't need to hear this.
Right. And I know it was hard for me, but I know it was hard for other people in my family as well. You know, I told you, my sister-in-law was just like, how could he be in hell? I thought God loved him.
Yeah.
And
I know.
I think like my response was that I don't think he is. And that whether you believe in an afterlife or not, you have mm-hmm. to recognize that if someone is in that much pain to make that mm-hmm. decision, that they need your understanding now. You know, like you can't hold on to the anger. You can't hold on to the anger because they didn't do what they did to hurt you. They exactly. did it because they needed
their
suffering to end. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know mm-hmm. this episode has been a little bit more like indulgent into my own issues, and I apologize if that bothered you, but I wanted to do something to commemorate him. And see, I know it will be a long time before I'm fully at peace with his death. But in the meantime, the things that are helping me to come to terms with it are understanding that his motivation was just to end an incredible amount of suffering. Not because yeah. he didn't love his family enough or anything like that.
Yeah.
And that the feeling that I've had that he has found healing in death and mm-hmm. that he's no longer in pain. And just yeah. holding on to the hope that someday we'll meet again. And I'm saving up big hug for him when that day comes.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's pretty much all I had. Do you have any thoughts, Crow?
No, I think you said everything that needed to be said.
We'll go ahead and wrap it up there then. Thank you for indulging a kind of different sort of episode. Crow, do you want to take us out?
Yeah. Okay, so if you enjoyed this episode, then feel free to give us a follow. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you really enjoyed this episode, then feel free to leave us a review because we would love to hear what you think. And also follow us on our social media. We're available on TikTok, Tumblr, Instagram, and Twitter. And we have an email if you want to tell us about the weird happenings in your life or what you want us to talk about next. But until next time, this is Crow and
this is Fern
signing off.
Bye.